From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Do intellectuals have a particular moral and political responsibility?
First, we have to ask, who are the people we call intellectuals? I mean, I've met unemployed workers who know more than and have better insight than people in the Harvard faculty.
I find the term public intellectual a bit iffy. I mean, it's not as if there's much point in being a private intellectual.
Today, we'll examine the role of the intellectual in today's world and hear from some of the world's most quoted and controversial figures, from Noam Chomsky to Christopher Hitchens. Also, why anthropologists have emerged as key players in U.S. military strategy.
The Second World War is the physicist war, the development in the Manhattan Project of the nuclear bomb. World War III, the war of deterrence, that was the political scientist war. And then finally, World War IV has been described as the anthropologist war. This is the war where you need to know the habits, the identity of the other.
But first, we turn to Noam Chomsky, who may be America's most prominent radical intellectual. For decades, Chomsky's carried on two quite distinct careers. A renowned professor at MIT, he is one of the fathers of modern linguistics. But his views on politics are what have made Chomsky a much admired, as well as reviled, public figure. He was an outspoken critic of U.S. foreign policy in the Vietnam War, and in a famous 1967 essay, urged intellectuals to speak the truth and expose lies. Chomsky has remained a fierce critic of American policy. Now in his early 80s, and still politically active, Noam Chomsky stopped by our studio just before receiving an award for Lifetime Contribution to Critical Scholarship from the University of Wisconsin's Havens Center. Steve Paulson spoke with him.
You have a status unlike any other public intellectual in America. You are one of the most quoted critics of American foreign policy in news outlets around the world. There was even a survey a few years ago ranking you as the top public intellectual in the world, ahead of people like Umberto Eco, Richard Dawkins, and Václav Havel. And yet you are virtually never quoted in the mainstream American media. How do you explain this?
How do I explain it? Well, I just heard recently from a, I don't know if I should mention him, a well-placed journalist who knows the field, that he told me that when A.M. Rosenthal became the managing editor of the New York Times, he issued a directive saying that I should not be quoted. And in fact, on paper, since we're at NPR, the co-host of All Thing Considered, Robert Siegel, wrote that I'm the one person they'll never allow on their primetime program.
And now, yet I read somewhere that the New York Times Book Review once referred to you as arguably the most important intellectual alive.
Well, that's a good reason why you shouldn't read press releases. It's true. The sentence was accurate. It came from a press release. But they didn't quote the next sentence. The next sentence was, how can he say such terrible things about American foreign policy?
So why don't we ever hear your name or see
your name? It's not just me. It's the media have a pretty narrow spectrum. It runs from, by world standards, it would be called far right to kind of center left, maybe.
Where do you put magazines like The Nation or, let's say, MSNBC in that spectrum?
I don't know anything about television, but The Nation would be a little to the left side of the spectrum. You know, even there, they have their limits, but I could write there. Yeah.
But you don't seem to be very interested.
I use other outlets mostly.
So why? Let's just focus on you for a moment and your particular political perspective. What is it that this media spectrum doesn't want to hear?
Take, say, the conflict with Iran. I mean, they're happy to hear criticism saying, you know, it'd be a mistake to bomb Iran. It'll cause more problems than it can solve and so on and so forth. What they don't want to hear, at least I've never seen in the media, with extremely rare exceptions, are core issues, like why the focus on Iran. So, for example, there's a new nuclear posture review, Obama's statement of nuclear policy. We're not threatening to attack non-nuclear states that observe the non-proliferation treaty, but there are a few what they called outliers to North Korea and Iran. Okay, put North Korea aside for the moment. Why is Iran an outlier? It signed the non-proliferation treaty. As far as anybody knows, it's living up to it. It's because the Obama administration claims that they have an intention of developing nuclear weapons. Okay, maybe they do, maybe they don't. But the fact that the government claims they have an intention of doing something makes them a threat, but not the countries that haven't ever signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty. There are three: India, Israel, and Pakistan. All developed nuclear weapons with U.S. aid. So they're not outliers. For the people of the region, that's not true. The people of the region and the Arab League had a conference recently, Turkey, a major country in the region, NATO ally. They want a peaceful settlement. If they regard a nuclear power as dangerous, it's Israel, and then on the periphery, Pakistan and India. But they're not outliers for us, because that is what defines U.S. policy, and it therefore sort of filters through, and it ends up being the media spectrum.
So if we just focus on Iran for the moment, you're saying there is a limited number of perspectives on what people say about Iran.
Very limited.
It's not acceptable to say that maybe Iran isn't really a threat?
Whether Iran's a threat or not, we could argue about. But to whom is it a threat, and what is the threat, and what do people in the region see as a threat? Now, that ought to be relevant. And first of all, Iran is not a threat in the sense that it's, if it had nuclear weapons and missiles, could it use them? I mean, if they so much as armed a missile, the country would be blown away. You can think what you like about the ruling clerics, but they've shown no desire to be incinerated along with everything they own.
Blown away by whom? By Israel?
By the United States. Israel doesn't have the capacity, but the United States can. No, I don't think any serious strategic analyst expects them to use nuclear weapons.
So we started out by talking about the media and what the media reports.
This is the kind of thing that the media wouldn't want an article about.
Is that true for the European media as well? Let's say newspapers in England, France, Germany, similar to American media?
There's some variations here and there, but fundamentally it's true. There are differences. So, for example, in the United States, it's unusually hard to write about Israel, easier in England. On the other hand, in England, it's harder to write about the Balkans. So it depends what they're involved with. And their own crimes are mostly off the agenda. There are variations. I mean, the one in this hemisphere, at least, the freest newspaper that I know of is in Mexico, La Jornada. It's the second largest newspaper in Mexico, very high quality. It gets no commercial advertising because business refuses to advertise in it, but it does extremely high quality work just based on people buying it.
I want to talk about the role of intellectuals, moral responsibility of intellectuals, which is something that you have written about over the years. You wrote a famous essay about this back in the 60s during the Vietnam War. Do intellectuals have a moral responsibility to speak out about politics?
Well, first we have to ask, who are the people we call intellectuals? I mean, they're not people who are smarter or have better ideas or better read. I mean, I've met unemployed workers who know more than and have better insight than people in the Harvard faculty. What we call intellectuals are people with a certain degree of privilege. They have resources, they have status, they have security.
Typically academic background, yeah, educational
say
background.
Academic, yeah. Privilege confers opportunity. Opportunity confers responsibility.
How would you assess how intellectuals, as you've just defined them, those with privilege, with opportunity, do they do a good job in this country speaking out about political matters?
I mean, there are exceptions, of course. But by and large, you know, they're servants of power. They do not do critical work. I mean, take, say the invasion of Iraq. A lot of debate and discussion about it, and there were critics, undoubtedly.
Huge critics. I mean, huge opposition to—
It was huge public opposition.
Yeah, to going into the war.
Take a look at intellectuals. I mean, among intellectuals, Obama is considered a principled critic of the Iraq invasion. What did he say? He said it's a strategic blunder.
As opposed to it was the wrong thing morally.
As wrong as it's a crime of aggression, it's a war crime.
So when you say most intellectuals in this country are servants of power because they're not speaking out
on
subjects like this?
They're not using the opportunity that they have. Incidentally, it's not the United States. This is pretty close to historically universal. It goes back as far as you like. I mean, take, say, the Bible. There are people in the Bible who we would call intellectuals. They didn't call them that then. We call them prophets. Who are the prophets? Well, there were people who were doing geopolitical analysis, condemning the crimes of the evil king, calling for mercy for widows and orphans. It's what we would call a radical intellectual. Mm-hmm. Were they treated nicely? Take a look at the Bible. They were treated horribly. I mean, there were people who were treated well, the flatterers at the court. Centuries later, they were called false prophets, but that's centuries later in the Gospels. That's the pattern through history. There's very few exceptions to this.
Now, you have taught for years, for decades at MIT. Have you had trouble there because of your political views?
Interestingly not, and it's quite interesting because during the 1960s particularly, I was seriously involved in not just protest but resistance activities. I was coming up for trial. It was an accident. It didn't happen. I was in a lab, which is 100% funded by the armed services. MIT altogether was about, I think, 90% Pentagon funded. No pressure at all. In fact, I was teaching undergraduate courses on my own time on the kinds of things we're talking about. I got a room, you know, nobody stopped me, and there was no pressure.
Why, do you think?
I have my own suspicions, you know, I never asked. For one thing, because it's a science-based university. And the sciences are quite different from the general university culture, not because they're nicer people or anything, but because the sciences survive on challenge. You want the students to challenge what you're saying, and that carries over to the culture.
I want to ask about some of the criticisms that are often leveled against you. I'm guessing that the most common charge you hear is that you hate America because you're always criticizing American policy, what our leaders are doing wrong. How do you respond to that charge?
Well, let me go back to the Bible again. It's an old complaint. The epitome of evil in the Bible was King Ahab. He called the prophet Elijah to him, and he condemned Elijah by saying, "Why are you a hater of Israel?" Well, why was Elijah a hater of Israel? He didn't hate Israel. He was condemning the acts of the evil king. In the old Soviet Union, Sakharov and others were called anti-Soviet. Did they hate Russia? No, they hated the government policies. I mean, if you take a totalitarian attitude and you identify the center of power, you identify it with the culture, the society, the people, and so on, then if you criticize the exercise of power, you hate the country. But that's only pure totalitarians can use those concepts.
Let me put the question another way. Have you ever been tempted to move to another country?
No. Grew up here, live here. A lot of wonderful things about the country. Why did Sakharov not leave Russia? He didn't like the government, but he wanted to be there. Quite apart from that, just on plain tactical grounds, I mean, if I couldn't stand it here, I'd still want to stay here because this is where changes can take place. You can live in Luxembourg if you want and maybe be free to say anything you feel like, but you're not going to change anything. The United States is overwhelmingly dominant in the world, and it's, by comparative standards, a very free country. So you can do things here you can't do elsewhere. But that's quite apart from just personal preference.
That's Noam Chomsky speaking with Steve Paulson. In a poll a few years ago, he was voted the world's leading living public intellectual. Now, in case you missed the beginning of our interview, Chomsky had this to say about how he's treated by the mainstream American media.
I just heard recently from a well-placed journalist who knows the field that he told me that when A.M. Rosenthal became the managing editor of the New York Times, he issued a directive saying that I should not be quoted. And in fact, on paper, since we're at NPR, the co-host of All Things Considered, Robert Siegel, wrote that I'm the one person they'll never allow on their primetime program.
Now, we thought Chomsky's comments deserve a response. A.M. Rosenthal has since died, but we did ask NPR's Robert Siegel for a statement. Here is what he wrote us. I quote, "This is simply not true. First, I do not allow people to appear on All Things Considered or bar them from appearing. I am one of three hosts on the program. I decide, or at least propose, whom I will interview, often at the suggestion of any one of a dozen producers and editors. I have never told a soul not to interview Noam Chomsky, not even informally. While I admit I am not especially an admirer of Chomsky, I did interview him once and didn't think much of the interview. The producer thought I did such a bad job he made me redo the interview. The experience did not leave me enthusiastic about repeating it. But deciding that I'm not interested in interviewing Noam Chomsky again would place him on a notional list of dozens of people I personally have no interest in interviewing. Never have I suggested to anyone else not to interview him on this program or any other NPR program. In fact, he appeared on All Things Considered recently in a story by Lourdes Garcia Navarro. While I suppose I have a narcissistic stake in the fiction that my influence, even when imagined and completely unexpressed, is somehow deeply influential on all my colleagues, editors, producers, co-hosts, supervisors, managing editors, vice presidents, any one of whom might propose a Noam Chomsky interview but refrain from doing so because of me, there is just no truth to this nonsense. There are actually people I have discovered who are under the misapprehension that I am still the news director of NPR, which I was from 1983 to 87. That was a long time ago. That Professor Chomsky should assert this about me without any substantiation, there is none, it is simply untrue, does nothing for his reputation as a truth-teller. If other truths he asserts are based on a comparable mix of rumor, resentment, and conspiracy theory, I'd suggest he get back to transformational grammar. That was Robert Siegel's email to us in response to a comment by Noam Chomsky. If you'd like to share your views on the media, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org or comment on our Facebook fan page. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. If you think academics just pontificate from their ivory towers, consider a U.S. military program called the Human Terrain System. In both Iraq and Afghanistan, the Department of Defense has hired civilian anthropologists and other social scientists as on-the-ground advisors to soldiers. The $40 million Human Terrain System now has more than 400 civilian scholars deployed in all 26 U.S. combat brigades in Iraq and Afghanistan. As you can imagine, this has proved quite controversial in the academic world. No one knows this better than James Derderian. He is a professor at Brown University and producer of the documentary Human Terrain, War Becomes Academic. And Strange Shamps asked Derderian about the controversy.
The American Anthropological Association has been pretty critical of the Human Terrain System. I guess one of the things I'm wondering is, do they see it as a kind of social science version of the Manhattan Project, in which academics are being pulled into the military?
Yes, it's part of a piece of a larger effort. Manhattan Project, which was the project, of course, to build the nuclear bomb before Germany during World War II. This language has actually been used by the military, in particular a retired Major General Robert Scales, who in a speech talked about the First World War being the chemist war, you know, because of gas. It's how you end a war. What's the sort of technological edge that helps bring victory? The Second World War is the physicist war, you know, development in the Manhattan Project of the nuclear bomb. World War III, the war of deterrence, that was the political scientist war, you know, the ones who gave game theory and systems theory a bad name, I think. And then finally, World War IV has been described by Scales and others as the anthropologist war. Now, this is the war where you need to know the habits, the identity of the other. Who is it? You know, if you go in hot or if you go in warm, you go in cold into another country, what do you need to know to either get along or to defeat an enemy?
And so the ethical issue for anthropologists is whether or not to become complicit in a military endeavor?
I don't think complicit in a military endeavor. Even the fiercest critics For instance, Hugh Gustafson in the film says anthropologists being hired on a daily basis to work with corporations. They've worked in the past with the military. It's the question of how is the knowledge being used? For what purpose? And there, that's where the ethical judgments are being made and where there's a difference of opinion on whether or not this knowledge is being used for merely information gathering for humanitarian purposes, or is it for prolonging occupation, or worse, is it being taken up the chain of command for targeting purposes?
9/11 was an attack by al-Qaeda against all Americans. Some people sort of say, well, the academics in America should not be involved in a war. Well, why not? We all died on 9/11. I think it's very appropriate that if academics believe that they understand a culture, that they help out, because we're all under attack by al-Qaeda. And for some Americans to say, oh, I'm an academic and therefore I'm not involved in this, is a lot of baloney.
I'm sure that there are plenty of senior military leaders who perfectly well understand that the Americans are involved in an imperial venture and they need military bases in that region. But there is a certain kind of rhetoric about how Americans have a mission to spread democracy, Americans only have the well-being of other people in mind. How could anyone possibly oppose what the Americans are doing? Once you go down that second track, you start to assume that the Americans are beneficent, then instead of reading resistance as inevitable resistance to foreign occupation, you start to think of it as some kind of cultural miscommunication. And you start to ask naive, misshapen questions. You know, if we only understood their culture better, how could we make them like us? Why do they hate us so much? They hate us because we're occupying their country, not because we don't understand their hand signals, and because occasionally we mistreat their women. So if you ask the wrong question, you get the wrong answer, and more people on both sides will die.
At the heart of your film is the story of your friend and colleague, Michael Batya, who, an anthropologist, who wound up participating in the human terrain system and was killed in Afghanistan. Can you tell me something about him?
He was someone who knew Afghanistan. He'd been there several times working with NGOs. He had been in many conflict zones, East Timor, West Africa, working either sort of, you know, for election observations or helping various humanitarian groups. So he was pretty, you know, he knew the turf, in other words. And in the process of doing research for us, he was recruited by the Human Terrain Program.
Hello, all. My greetings from Fort Benning, Georgia. After 2 intense months at Fort Leavenworth and a brief foray down to the JRTC at Fort Polk, I head out this evening for Kuwait and then Afghanistan. I'll be joining the human terrain team in Khost, Afghanistan, as a social scientist. I will be spending a good amount of time over the next several days in what the military calls hurry up and wait. I expect I'll be in Afghanistan for at least 9 months. While the program has proven to be controversial and widely reported, I am optimistic that given the right participants, the program has a real chance of reducing both the Afghan and American lives lost. Contrary to some of the criticism, I am not involved in covert research or activities, or in lethal targeting or interrogation. To no doubt, I will confront many challenges there, as I'm already preparing for both the real and ethical minefields. I look forward to hearing from everyone over the next year, and welcome any message of criticism, inquiry, or support.
How did he die?
On May 7th, 2008, he was going out to help mediate an intertribal dispute up in the mountains surrounding Khost. He was leaving from a forward operating base, Salerno. They stopped the convoy en route, and the lead commander of this company asked if Michael would come and ride with him in the lead Humvee. So he switches Humvees, and that Humvee was destroyed pretty much by a command control IED, a roadside bomb. And two soldiers were killed, two lost their legs, and Michael was killed.
How did you all hear about it?
The next day his mother called. Let us know.
I guess I can't imagine how his colleagues would have reacted, given that you probably all had very mixed feelings about an anthropologist joining the military anyway.
Believe me, you know, we went through the stages of grief very quickly. And yeah, I mean, probably the toughest thing I've had to do as a professor, as a colleague, is go to a friend's funeral and under these circumstances, you know, deal with the sort of mixed emotions, but obviously also the mixed kind of ethical, intellectual response to this really tore a lot of people up.
He was always doing something greater than himself. Why this as opposed to the other things? That's the difficult question we're having to answer. And I think this also relates to how other people see this death, the politicization of his death, because a lot of people will say another fallen comrade on the front lines in the war on terror. But he was not a nationalist, he was an internationalist, ideologically, philosophically, culturally. And it would be a misunderstanding, a misinterpretation of what he stood for, what he was about, if he is viewed through the lens of nationalism.
You said the argument has been made that this is, in some ways, the anthropologist's war. I guess I'm curious, what do you personally think about that? How does it make you, how do you respond as an anthropologist to the idea that your profession's insights and methodology are being used, are important in this war?
You know, you look at Kissinger's history as an international relations expert, or, there's a sort of a history of the revolving door between academia and policy making. And I'm not, and I'm not ideologically opposed to this. I am, however, if I can use this word, epistemologically opposed, because I think to pretend that you can maintain your objectivity while trying to use your knowledge for another purpose besides critical inquiry really just sort of undermines the whole basis of scholarship. So I'm against this, it's fine if people want to wear both hats, but if you try to do it simultaneously, don't try to pretend that you're, one and not the other. I mean, you're not a scholar when you're advising somebody who has the power to shape, policies that have direct impact on funding and with the military, obviously on matters, as I said before, of, life and death.
So we go out to the villages and to the cities and talk to the Iraqis, get an idea of their perceptions, their feelings, basically what they're thinking about their culture. And then we take that back to the military so they have a better understanding of the local population.
A scene from James Dredarian's documentary film Human Terrain, War Becomes Academic. Anne Strainsham spoke with Dredarian.
Aristotle had the ingredients of a theory of justice that I think is very powerful, and that is that it's the job of a good political arrangement to provide each and every person with what they need to become capable of living rich and flourishing human lives.
That's University of Chicago philosopher Martha Nussbaum, who is one of the philosophers featured in the documentary film Examined Life. The movie interviews 8 prominent philosophers, including Cornel West, Peter Singer, Judith Butler, and Slavoj Žižek. I have to say, this film reminds me a lot of what we do right here, on To the Best of Our Knowledge. It's not surprising, since the filmmaker, Astra Taylor, calls herself a serious generalist, and clearly loves to play with big ideas. But I had to wonder, why make a movie about philosophy?
I wanted to make a film about philosophy in part because there were none, or there were very few movies that address philosophy or even ideas directly. I guess I wanted a challenge because when I mentioned this concept to people early on, they looked at me like I was absolutely crazy. I mean, what could be less cinematic?
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because it does seem to be a subject that is maybe more radio.
Absolutely. And that was a question I asked myself a lot. Why make a movie? Because radio is an excellent format for conversing, as we're doing now, for talking about ideas and for conveying intellectual drama, I think. In fact, it's arguably the perfect medium because it's a lot cheaper. So,
when they talk about this kind of conversation on television or on the screen, they talk about talking heads.
Right. Talking heads is never a compliment. It's always an insult. Right.
Right.
And so what I did, of course, was I made walking heads. My subjects are in motion. And so that was, I had this epiphany that moving images need to move. That's what cinema is. And so I struck upon this idea of the walk, because if you go back to the figure of Socrates, who I'm, of course, referencing in the title of the film, Examine Life, he said the unexamined life is not worth living. You know, we have this image of him in the agora talking to passersby and sort of provoking them and being playful and ultimately raising issues that upset the authorities. And he was, of course, forced to drink the hemlock. So this idea of philosophy beginning in the streets, in public space, and being a public act, right? I wanted to play with that. It's this motif that goes on and on and on until a certain point when suddenly philosophy goes into the academy, right? It becomes professionalized, and suddenly we think of philosophy as something that you do in a library, not in public space, for sure.
But then you start the film with Cornel West seated inside a car. Mm-hmm. The movement is all around you. And mm-hmm. in fact, he's sitting in the back seat of the car, isn't he? You're driving him through Manhattan, and he's talking to the back of your head.
Well, yeah, I wanted to update the peripatetic motif. But how would a philosopher move around today? Well, they didn't have mopeds or bicycles or electric wheelchairs back then, so I wanted to take advantage of the different forms of movement. I was also on a budget, because that is the bane of every documentary filmmaker's existence. So I couldn't even afford a chauffeur to drive us around the city. I put Cornel West in the back of my $800 Volvo station wagon and drove him around myself. But he has this accelerated way of speaking and, you know, and I wanted to show him zooming around the city and the way that what he saw outside the window would you know, impact his thinking. And then he would sort of riff off of the stimulus.
See, I'm a blues man in the life of the mind. I'm a jazz man in the world of ideas. Therefore, for me, music is central. So when you're talking about poetry, for the most part, Plato was talking primarily about words, whereas I talk about notes, I talk about tone, I talk about temper, I talk about rhythms. See, for me, music is fundamental. Philosophy must go to school not only with the poets, philosophy needs to go to school with the musicians.
You know, there are multiple layers on which you can interpret what's being said in the film, and I really wanted to not have it be a documentary where only those who have PhDs in philosophy would understand what's being said, right? So he's saying different things at the same time.
You did that a little bit with the next philosopher, too, Avital Ronell. You have her interviewed while you're walking with her through New York's, what is it, Tompkins Square Park?
Yep.
And I have to tell you, there was some amusement in watching the people she passed as you walked, at the same time that she was talking about her critique of the quest for meaning. And I suppose you're walking backward, too, must have given them a smile or two.
That was one of my favorite shoots. There's something about the park and the space. It really was full of all sorts of different types of people. And they regarded us with a sort of a curiosity and also a suspicion. So there's this one moment early on in the film where she's walking and she's talking about how we should, yes, be suspicious of meaning and resist this idea to wrap everything up. And this fellow on a bench removes very slowly only one of his two headphones. You know, as though he's not quite committed to listening to this stuff just yet. And I kind of thought that's where the audience is 5 minutes in. They're like, is this a bunch of hot air or is this really interesting? I'm not quite there.
Why do you think that Avital Ronell is so skeptical about our hunger for meaning?
Well, I think it's an important thing to be skeptical of, especially if you're about to embark on some sort of philosophical adventure. I play with that in the form of the film itself. So you'll notice that they're on these excursions, right? These walks or these journeys, but they don't ever, my subjects never get anywhere. So Avital walks around the park, you know, or Michael Hart rows around the lake in Central Park. But
and,
the point
and
is.
And in fact, rows his boat into a rock at one point, doesn't he?
Yes, right when he's having a sort of conceptual difficulty, he hits this rock, and it was this, you know, wonderful symbolic moment where you're like, I've conceptually run aground. But
you,
the point
you
is.
You couldn't have written that.
No, and those are the moments where I felt like I was on a good track. But the point is, you know, with philosophy, we're always going back over these old issues, right? Meaning, justice, truth, beauty, right? These things that are, you kind of can't close the book on them. And so I think, you know, Avital comes in very early and she says, hey, you know, we've got to wonder whether we really know enough or we know it all. Maybe we need to be a bit skeptical, but also still be rigorous, right?
And don't forget that Heidegger ditched philosophy for thinking. Because he thought philosophy as such was still too institutional, academic, too bound up in knowledge and results, too cognitively inflected. So he asked the question, what is called thinking? And he had a lot to say about walks about going on paths that lead nowhere. One of his important texts is called Holzwege, which means a path that leads nowhere. In Greek, the word for path is methodos. So we're on the path.
You chose to have them walking. Did they choose where they were going to walk?
No, I mean, I would never put my subjects in a place where they felt uncomfortable. So only Slavoj Žižek would dig around that garbage dump outside of London. Now, I knew that that was a place he'd be really contented.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Slavoj Žižek, who is the Slovenian. You've, in fact, done a film on him before, I think.
Yeah.
And if there is a wild man in this film, he's it, in London, poking through the trash. He chose that, but obviously you thought it was a good idea.
You know, I had already done a film with him, and so I wrote him, and I said, well, what should we discuss? And he said, ecology. And I said, aha, we're going to do it at a garbage dump. So I knew, and I also knew that he would go for it.
Well, the funny thing is, he seems to enjoy it so clearly, and mm-hmm. as part of his philosophy, he dismisses ecology, ecological thinking, as wrongheaded and says, doesn't he at some point say we should become more artificial?
Well, it's interesting. You know, he doesn't negate the need to intervene, for example, in climate change or deny climate change. He says we absolutely have to do something, but it's quite, he's trying to get us mostly to rethink the division between the natural and the unnatural.
What we expect from religion is a kind of a unquestionable highest authority. It's got work, so it is, you don't debate it. Today, I claim ecology is more and more taking over this role of a conservative ideology. Whenever there is a new scientific breakthrough, biogenetic development, whatever, it is as if the voice which warns us not to trespass, violate a certain invisible limit, like don't do that, it would be too much. That voice is today more and more the voice of ecology, like don't mess with DNA, don't mess with nature, don't do it.
This he's more trying to get us to rethink certain pieties that are part of the environmental discourse. And, you know, that's what a lot of philosophers, that's what they're there to do, right, is to get us to sort of question our assumptions, our preconceptions, our pieties. That's why I made Examine Life the film that it is. I wanted to touch people on the level of their everyday experience.
Well, and every film is to some extent about the filmmaker, too, isn't
yes.
it? I read a little bit about you, and it says in the piece that I read, it said you were homeschooled. You didn't even have a mm-hmm. curriculum.
We called it unschooling. We called it unschooling because it was to signify that we didn't even do schooling at home. We were allowed to do whatever we wanted and follow our curiosity. And so we did have this phrase, the world is our classroom. So I think the idea of philosophy being in the streets is very much speaks to the idea of the world being the classroom. You know, I kept thinking the phrase, build an inquisitive momentum, you know, for when the film is over. It doesn't give you a sort of 10-point plan on how to live or something, but it makes you feel like you want to go and research more and learn more.
So do you have to go to school to be a philosopher?
Oh, God, no. Thank God you don't have to go to school. No, a philosopher is a lover of wisdom. Takes tremendous discipline, takes tremendous courage to think for yourself, to examine yourself. That Socratic imperative of examining yourself requires courage. You know, William Butler Yeats used to say, it takes more courage to examine the dark corners of your own soul than it does for a soldier to fight on the battlefield.
That's Cornel West, one of the philosophers featured in Astra Taylor's film Examined Life. You'll find a link to the film on our website at ttbook.org. Up next, Christopher Hitchens. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking this hour about the moral and political responsibility of intellectuals. It's a question that has long obsessed the journalist and author Christopher Hitchens. His new memoir, Hitch 22, recounts his own engagement with the great controversies of our time, from the Cuban Revolution and the Vietnam War to the war in Iraq. The book is also a funny and often gossipy account of Hitchens' many feuds and famous friends. Steve Paulson talked with Christopher Hitchens about the role of the intellectual.
I think it's fair to say that there is no one else quite like you with your combined history of being a political activist, a journalist, a cultural critic, your prominence in the media, and your swing in politics from Trotskyite to something more conservative. Do you think the label public intellectual describes what you have done professionally?
I say in the book that I find the term public intellectual a bit iffy. I mean, it's not as if there's much point in being a private intellectual, for example. I mention it in connection with Susan Sontag, actually. I think the definition has to include someone who is in some way self-sustaining, doesn't have a job in the academy or anything of that sort, who keeps themselves going. It probably ought to include, yes, as you suggest, something to do with engagement with the political sphere, but not in such a way as to be completely politicized.
Now, clearly, taking a stand on the big issues of the day has been central to you throughout your life, whether it was the Vietnam War, or the old Soviet Union, or more recently, the war in Iraq. Do you consider this your responsibility?
Yes, I think it's a responsibility for people, even if they are not wholly political or politicized, to try and have educated opinions about major public issues.
Is this a matter of, as you put it at one point in your book, adding up the moral arithmetic when you weigh in on the big and complex issues of the day?
Yes, it is. But I think one has an obligation in the case of a conflict, say, to decide who you think might be in the right or who you think might be the victim. Let me phrase it like this. Very often, the job of the intellectual, so to speak, is to say, well, remember how complex this subject is. Remember how it doesn't yield to simple solutions. But very often also, I think it's important for the intellectuals to say, you know what, this is quite simple. I can think of a couple of examples in the fairly recent past. Though Bosnia is a very complicated society, it seems to most of us who'd spent any time there or looked at any of the evidence that actually, in spite of the sort of ethnic mosaic of the place and the layers of complexity involved in religion and culture, that actually fairly obviously an attempt was being made to erase the Muslim culture of Bosnia and as many of its population as could be by a very strong, horrible, irredentist Serbian-backed militia, and thus that for all the complexity, there was a fairly simple thing to say, which is that oughtn't really to be allowed. That would mean there'd been another genocide in Europe in the 20th century. That would be bad.
So it was incumbent upon intellectuals or people who had some political persuasion, perhaps, to make the case for outside foreign intervention.
I certainly thought so, yes, and several did, and not without effect either. And I think the ultimate result was very heartening. Another case I would make, and I've got a whole chapter about this in my book, is about Salman Rushdie. A lot of people decided that in the case of the fatwa against him, that's to say, on February 14th, 1989, theocratic leader of a foreign state offers money in his own name to have Salman killed for the crime of writing a novel when he's not an Iranian and doesn't live in Iran and lives in London. I thought, well, that's pretty simple. This is a challenge to our simplistic ideas of free speech in the First Amendment.
And what was surprising is a lot of people on both the right and the left essentially blamed Rushdie more than the Ayatollah.
Indeed. They started talking about profanities, various kinds of postmodern nonsense. As you say, a lot of conservatives did this, and a lot of conservative churchmen in the Vatican and the Church of England and among Orthodox Jews said the problem is blasphemy, not the fatwa. Extraordinary. Also, it was an early warning to me. So did quite a lot of rather shady leftists who were beginning this mantra that's now become quite large and quite loud, that, you know, Islam is a religion of the poor and the brown and the downtrodden and the oppressed, and that it's wrong to criticize it because it's a great consolation to these people.
But don't you have to parse this out? I mean, there are moderate reformist Muslims and there are fanatical Muslims. I mean, don't you have to make those distinctions?
Well, I should have said very much you do, yes. But, I mean, you get people saying, but, you know, these Al-Qaeda guys, they wouldn't be around if it wasn't for poverty and unemployment. And I say that's completely the wrong way around. What they do is not protest against poverty and unemployment. They are the creation of it. They are the ones who want to deprive society of the talents of 50% of its members, the female half. They're the ones who want to blow up anything modern, who want to bring the world back to the 14th century. But you'd be amazed by how often people have a sort of naive view that this is a this must be some kind of third world protest movement.
Now, part of your story is the romance of the left, and perhaps it was never more pronounced in the late 60s when you and other would-be revolutionaries went off to Cuba to see the revolution up close. You came away from that trip fairly disillusioned, didn't you?
Yes. I hadn't gone with any huge illusions, I have to say, because I was a member of a rather anti-communist, anti-Castroite left opposition group of a sort of Trotskyist character. We had many doubts about Fidel, as people used to call him, but I suppose I wanted to see if it was true that you could have in Cuba a revolution that wasn't one of those drab, uniform, dull, conformist Eastern European satellite-type regimes. That was the claim, that it wasn't going to be like that, but different. A very young country in those days, a very young revolution, only a few years old, Che Guevara only recently dead, rather a sexy place, full of young revolutionaries from around the world, some of whom later became terrorists, who I knew, so Red Brigade or Angry Brigade types, some of whom later took part in the liberation of South Africa as guerrillas. You never knew. Lots to play for. But somehow this atmosphere of control. They took my passport when I arrived at Havana Airport and wouldn't give it back. I said, you'll get it back when you leave. I didn't like that. Just a small thing. I felt immediately not at home. But still, some inspirational stuff, too. So I try and describe it with ambivalence.
One of your icons is clearly George Orwell, and my guess is if you had to pick a model public intellectual, it would be Orwell. Why does he remain the gold standard for you?
Well, I try and describe it in the book when I talk about my early upbringing in the lower middle class in Britain. You know, everyone takes a long time to say which class they think they're in my country, but let's say just escaping from the working class kind of. I was drawn to reading Orwell not by his two classic anti-totalitarian novels, but by the English social novels. They're much less known, but I recommend to any of your listeners, in particular Coming Up for Air and Keep the Aspidistra Flying and A Clergyman's Daughter, that describe with extreme realism and sympathy the sort of class of person that I came from, these sort of imperial civil service, military, suburban and seaside towns, no money to spare, fear of the labour movement beneath, and slightly cowed and resentful of the upper class above. He caught it so well.
But my sense is more than just you're identifying with his class and how he wrote about it, that you have the sense that he wrestled with the big issues, the big controversies of the day, and for the most part came out on the right side.
Oh, well, yes, but later on, of course, I should have added. I mean, armed only, this is my point, armed only with really one thing, which was a certain literary ability, as he put it, and a power of facing unpleasant facts. In other words, he more or less decided to refuse himself the lie. If I don't think something is true, I'm not going to pretend it is, because it might be politically convenient. I'll see what happens if I don't lie to myself or others.
Give me an example of that.
Well, the best example we have is the argument about what actually happened in Barcelona in May 1937 when there was a civil war among the left. These are always, as I keep saying in my book, the most dramatic and painful of all is the revolution within the revolution and the fratricide within the left. And a lot depends upon whether or not this was triggered by the Spanish Communist Party on the orders of Stalin, essentially trying to bring off a coup, seizing the telephone exchange and various army positions in Barcelona, and using this to put down the left in a kind of pogrom. And Orwell said that it was true. And he said, I can't prove it to you. I can say I saw it. It's a book called Homage to Catalonia that's since become very famous. It was almost unprocurable for many years because people thought he'd just made it up. Now, we now have the archives long after his death, both from the KGB in Moscow and from the Franco forces in Salamanca in Spain. And, as it happens, he was telling the unvarnished truth. It was at that point that he realized that many people could rewrite history even while it was going on, so as to make it seem as if certain events had never occurred in the first place. And that was the germ of his great idea for 1984 for Animal Farm. So all of that begins from this one piece of fratricide within the Marxist movement in Catalonia.
Now, your last chapter is titled Decline, Mutation, or Metamorphosis, with a question mark, and it deals with your turn away from the left. And you say this wasn't just a dreary shuffle to the right, and you also suggest that it has something to do with your advancing age and your realization that there are no certainties. How do you explain this shift in your politics?
Well, I've had various commitments and allegiances in my life. I wouldn't say that I wouldn't do them again. I'm not ashamed of them. Some of them I wish I'd done more about. But I've now reached a point where the group I'm most associated with, Richard Dawkins and a group of our friends, is a group that is united really on commitment only to doubt. We're certain only of the uncertainty principle. That may sound like a soft position to end up in, but in fact it's not, because in the present circumstances it commits us very strongly against the modern form of totalitarianism, the theocratic kind in particular.
A lot of people would of course put a different spin on that, not just that you have embraced doubt, but that you've essentially joined the neoconservative camp when it comes to politics in the Middle East, specifically the war in Iraq.
Well, I think whatever word should be used for the regime change faction, of which I certainly was a member, I think neoconservative must be the silliest, because it's a faction that says we're prepared to make war on, to use violence against the status quo. I don't think you can call that conservative. Whatever it is, that's a radical position. And it was the conservatives who opposed it. I mean, the papacy, the Kissinger realists, the Scowcroft, Eagleburg a lot.
Well, you were recently interviewed in the New York Times, and you said you still consider yourself a Marxist, though a very conservative Marxist, which I have to say I found very surprising.
Yeah, well, I still think like a Marxist. The materialist conception of history works for me. I don't think it's been superseded or transcended. I think the categories of Marxist analysis are very satisfying. And also, I think much of the best modern history has been written by Marxists and from a Marxist analytical point of view. What it isn't easy for me to say, or actually possible for me to say anymore, is that I'm a socialist. But Marxism doesn't commit you to that. Marxism is a supposedly objective theory, and its prescriptive bits, well, they're optional.
Christopher Hitchens, talking with Steve Paulson. Hitchens is a contributing editor to Vanity Fair. His memoir is called Hitch 22. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to comment on what you've just heard, send us an email through our website at ttbook.org or visit us on our Facebook fan page. You can buy a CD of the show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for The Responsibility of Intellectuals, number 620A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Anne Strainchamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, Veronica Rickert, and Doug Gordon. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.